When he had concluded, and his spirit influence had left him, he found himself strangely fatigued, as well he might be after such an unwonted effort, which had called into play this highest intellectual and spiritual flowers, and the audience, in commenting upon his address, said, "He talked as if he were inspired." Little did they realize the meaning and truth of their own words. 60 Returning to the spirit spheres, I found everywhere each one at work the same as upon earth, and at as great a variety of, and similar, employments, only there was this difference, there was no manifestation of corroding care, no complaint of weariness, no apparent desire to shirk their appointed tasks. Each worked as though it were not only a duty but a pleasure to be thus employed, and as I questioned the different ones, I came to understand that, unlike the manners of earth, where circumstances or misjudgment of others force many into employments entirely uncongenial to them, and in which they can take neither pleasure nor hope to excel because of their want of taste and adaptability, in the new life with which I was trying to familiarize myself, the work of each was that best suited to his or her tastes and abilities, and for that reason was an enjoyment and not a task. Labor was no longer a bondage enthralling body and soul, and dwarfing the intellect, but a delight which aided the faculties to expand and develop themselves in healthful ways. All professions, all occupations, seemed represented. There were teachers, preachers and physicians. Though the spirit world is on earth represented as a place where there is no illness, it is a misrepresentation, for there are sick souls who need the care of those who know how to minister to a mind diseased. Their ailments are moral and spiritual ones, and require like remedies. Thus the pharmacopoeia of the earthly druggist is unknown here. Another class of physicians devoted themselves wholly to the healing of mortals, using both material and spiritual methods in accomplishing their cures, sometimes effecting them directly, at other times through the interposition of mediums. It has been remarked by one who thought he was saying a witty thing, that there are no lawyers in heaven. True, there are no lawyers as you understand the term on earth, but there are spirits here who make the natural and spiritual laws of the universe their especial study, and whose business it is to explain to such as have not the time or the taste for thorough investigation, those laws which most directly concern their being. Their business is not to mystify and evade the laws, as their namesakes do on earth, but to elucidate them, and as far as possible secure their obedience. 61. Everywhere, pervading everything, I was permitted to perceive a subtle magnetic bond which connected the spiritual and material worlds so that the reality of the former was shadowed forth more or less distinctly in the latter. In their transmission from the higher to the lower plane of life, there was always more or less lost. The spiritual thought became materialized, the divine truth lost its perfect luster, the all-pervading love, which actuates the good works of the spirit world, when its beams had penetrated through the clouds, and must I say it, the moral and intellectual miasma of earth, took on tinges of selfishness and phases of wrongly directed effort. The divine ideal became humanized and consequently defective. The picture lost much of its brilliancy, the poem its spirituality, the story, instead of being the record of spiritual experiences, told of earthly woes, and recognized only earthly ideals of happiness. The invention was never quite complete. The discovery still left something undiscovered. Everything bore the mark of the finite, of the limited intelligence, the imperfect nature of humanity. Nevertheless, the link was there and bound the two worlds together, making them, in a certain sense, interdependent, the one upon the other, certainly the lower upon the higher life. If these invisible bonds were severed, the earth would be left in spiritual darkness, and moral chaos would be the result. There would be no hope for the future, no means for progress, and retrogression would become the law of humanity. If these bonds were severed, on the other hand, the spirit world would find itself without a motive for much of its present work, and would in time also fall into spiritual darkness, as it became peopled with degraded and darkened spirits from earth life. 63 All this I did not perceive of my own wisdom, but it was kindly and patiently explained to me by those who had a broader experience and fuller knowledge than I, and as I gradually came to comprehend the truth, how many things it made clear which had been mysterious to me while on Earth. It revealed that there was an ordering of, and a purpose in, all things, and that the word chance have no longer any place in the language, except as a name for something which existed not. There was a rare privilege accorded me. Again I find myself at a loss how to describe to you my experience, since there is nothing in earth life which parallels it. I have to resort to the inadequate phraseology of the senses in order to convey to your mind a comprehension of results. It seemed as though I saw, or heard, or felt I knew not which, or how. No, I cannot tell you. I will only say that it was revealed to me in a way I cannot describe, because I cannot make you understand, that strong but invisible bonds, the same in character as those which connect the earth to the spirit world, connect the lower spheres of the latter world with the higher ones, and on these spiritual wires, if I may so call them, descend truths from these higher spheres which enlighten those beneath them. The poet who, while on earth, wrote his rare poems through inspiration from above, had not, in passing through the gateway of death, acquired a faculty of original thought and expression. While still on earth, he inspired many lesser poets by the beauty, vigor and truth of his productions. Passing onward, when he was freed from the limitations of the body, he was enabled to exercise this faculty of inspiring others in far greater degree, so that many earthly poets sang faint echoes of his spiritual songs. But he in his turn was receiving grander inspiration from poets who had ascended to greater spiritual heights, and was himself probably echoing faintly the more glorious and perfect measures of the celestial spheres. Can it be that all truth, all beauty, all love, all wisdom, are sent off from the great central source like rays of light from your earthly sun, permeating all matter and all intelligence? Should we not, then, both mortals and spirits, so fit ourselves that the divine beams may penetrate our souls? 63. Chapter 7. Blessed are the pure in heart. I cannot tell how long it was after this, but probably not long, that Margaret came and said a new lesson was prepared for me if I was ready to receive it. Thirsting for knowledge, I eagerly assented. A mortal was just crossing to the hither side of the river of death, and it should be my privilege to be one of those who should welcome her, and give her the first instructions concerning the spirit land. It was a task which I longed, yet dreaded to accept. I thought it must be rarely sweet to help dispel the terrors with which most mortals, trained in an erroneous theology, are sometimes beset, upon their first entrance into the life unknown, but I myself felt so ignorant, so inadequate to what seemed required of me. Margaret reassured me, and told me the needs of the moment would suggest what I should say and do. Moreover, I was not to go alone. Others would accompany me, and a large band of spirits would wait to welcome the pilgrim as she reached the spirit sphere. I had but one companion, a man apparently in the prime of life, whose countenance bore the traces of a noble nature. We found the dead, the newly born, still in the deep unconsciousness which, in the case of many, accompanies the passage of one life to the other. She was a woman well advanced in years, but even in the sleep of death, with all the traces of the cares and sorrows and the sins of life, for who are there without sin? And in spite of the grey hair, furrowed cheek and brow, there was a look of divine peace upon her face, a look which seemed so habitual that it had softened the lines and wrinkles, and rested in the curve of the lips. 64. Surely this was a saint upon earth, I exclaimed reverently as we stood beside her. You speak truly, was my companion's response, and as I glanced at him when he uttered these words, I detected a resemblance between the two. Therefore I was not surprised when, bending over the sleeping form, he uttered the word, Mother. The sleeper opened her eyes, and a joyful light shone in them as they fell upon her son. She stretched out her arms exclaiming, At last! At last! I turned aside and left mother and son to this their first interview, after having been severed, and then united, by death. Then when they needed me I reunited, and by kind words and necessary explanations sought to make the woman understand that she was at last really free from the earthly bondage. Then we half led, half bore her away from earth, and as we approached the spirit land, lo, A great throng came out to meet us, and gathering around, they welcomed her with terms of love and gratitude, as one would welcome a friend and savior. Each had some story to tell of a kindness done, of a word spoken in season, of sympathy accorded when most needed, of faults gently reproved in brief, of work which an angel might do and be proud of, but which had been done by a weak, an erring woman, for are we not all weak and erring in the earth life? I felt my heart go out in a sudden gush of affection towards this woman, and I fancied that one of the greatest privileges the spirit world could bestow, would be to give me her sincere friendship. She seemed one among a thousand, and instead of teaching her I might learn from her. You shall not lose sight of her, said Margaret, to whom I expressed this wish. But I have something to tell you regarding her. If these very ones who have so eagerly welcomed her here today, and who have so gratefully acknowledged the benefits she has conferred upon them, had, while still in their mortal existence, known her true history, they would have turned from her as from a woman accursed. 65. Would they have been just in so doing? I asked in wonder. Oh, earthly vision is one thing, and spiritual vision is another. Does her face bear the stamp of the blessing or the curse of heaven? Its blessing, assuredly. Then let not what I have told you lead you to prejudge and misjudge. Wait until you know her full history, which shall presently be revealed to you, and then we shall be able to measure your spiritual progress by the judgment which you accord this woman. Meantime there is one place within your reach which you have not visited. Will you do so now? The direction that we took I remember not, nor the time occupied in reaching our destination. The air grew chilly, and the sky took a steely blue. The light was dazzling, and the scene one of rare beauty, but so cold, oh, so cold. I shivered as the breath of winter fell upon me. I then recalled what Mary, the ministering angel, had said about the domain of winter. In the distance snow-crowned mountains gleamed and glittered in the sunlight, and giant icebergs, carved in a thousand beautiful and fantastic shapes, reflected all the colors of the prism. Rivers of ice wound their way through the landscape, dazzling in the light, but currentless. The trees were cased in crystals, reflecting the light from a thousand points, while the flowers and shrubbery were seemingly of congealed vapor, as fantastically beautiful as the frost tracery upon earthly windows. Silver and crystal everywhere, pearls and diamonds, but no warmth of color, no warmth of light, beautiful and cold. The very houses were ice palaces or ice cottages, more radiant than marble. I saw many people who seemed for the most part perfectly content with their climate, as though they had never wished for or perhaps known any other, only I noticed that now and then one shivered slightly, as if unconsciously. 66. A strange object met my view here. As strange as was everything about me, this object, being found anywhere in the spirit world, seemed out of place. It was a man who wore only the scantiest of rags, and carried upon his back a sort of sack. He was seeking here and there for rubbish of any and every sort, which, when found, he gathered up and put in his bag with an eagerness that amounted almost to a greed. He shivered continually, and now and then muttered to himself, "I am so cold. Will I never be warm again?" When he met a passerby he held out his hand as if asking alms. Are there then beggars and tramps in the spirit world? Yes, many, was the reply of my companion. They are found principally in this and the lower spheres, though they occasionally wander even into higher ones. They belong nowhere, as they have no home. You are astonished and want an explanation. Well, I will tell you what this man was, which will account for what he is. In earth life there was once a merchant prince whose name was a power in the financial world. Rising from poverty and obscurity, he reached the topmost round of the financial ladder. He was strictly honest as the world counts honesty. He told no business lies. He met all his obligations promptly and fully, but he was selfish to his heart's core. He oppressed the poor. He paid his employers the lowest wages for which he could get men and women to work, and when old age overtook them, he turned them off to linger on and finally to die in destitution, and put younger ones in their places. If he ever gave to charity, He did it blowing a trumpet before him, so that he might reap a sevenfold advantage in his business. There was not one man or woman in all the world, outside his own family, who could say that they had ever known him to speak a genuinely kind word or do an unselfish act. In his veins seemed to flow ice instead of blood. At last he passed away, and not one human being was the better for his having lived, save those who inherited his money. 67 He had heaped up wealth on earth, but he could not take a penny of it with him, and, though he belonged to an aristocratic and exclusive church, he had utterly neglected to lay up treasures in heaven. He had not even builded himself a house. Therefore you behold him homeless, friendless, destitute, begging of those whom he once oppressed. It is the old story of Dives and Lazarus revised. True to the instinct of greed which governed him on earth, he must accumulate something, and as his accumulations they were utterly worthless when gauged by the standard of eternity, so he goes on gathering worthless rubbish. This story gave me much to think about, but I put it aside for the present, in the more absorbing interest which the scene awakens. But what strange place is this, I asked, where winter seems to reign perpetually? This, Margaret responded, is the realm of pure intellect and of self. Truth sheds its light here, but the beams of love which lighten and vivify the sphere from which we came, never descend, never melt the perpetual ice and snow of this fairy-like scene, never warm human hearts. Here those who lived purely intellectual lives find their congenial home, men who were given up wholly to scientific and business pursuits, and never cultivated the affections, men who were honest and upright from pride or instinct, but who never knew the meaning of the word charity, men who sought to be just but not merciful, men who were never stirred by kindly or affectionate impulses toward their own sex, and who knew not the higher meaning of the word love in their association with each other. Here some of the so-called wisest men and the brightest geniuses of earth have found themselves upon their first entrance to the spirit world. But as truth may and does enter here, it furnishes an open door through which they may pass, if they will, to the warmer spheres beyond. 68 It was a very curious scene to me. I watched its inhabitants one after another as they were busy at their world, for they, too, were all busy. Margaret at last directed my attention towards one man, and told me to study him well. I did so, and this was the story that was gradually revealed to my intelligence. I seemed to see a young boy possessing a warring nature, irreconcilable with itself, growing up in poverty and obscurity, and compelled to fight the battle of life against heavy odds. He was a strange boy, not silent but uncommunicative, and nobody understood him, and as he grew up, and peculiar inherited traits developed themselves, he became a strange man, and people understood him still less, though few ever realized the fact. Surrounded in all the years from early youth up to the prime of manhood by adverse circumstances of diverse character, beset by temptations to which he yielded, and giving way to weaknesses of character that seemed to continually clog his progress, there was some subtle power which guided and protected him, and which, while he constantly struggled with the circumstances of his life and his own inherent weaknesses, and almost as constantly failed, and thus seemed to be continually descending, yet constantly urged him upward and onward in a moral and intellectual progress, which he himself comprehended quite as little as anyone else, yet this progress seemed almost wholly objective, and only stamped the outside of his nature, not entering into it deeply. By all precedents given his character, prenatal antecedents, and the surroundings of his life, with its temptations, and its absence of opportunities for development in right directions, he should have descended until he found his level with the ignorant and the degraded. But his subjective development was purely intellectual. He seemed a man almost without moral perceptions when judged inwardly, though his outward character had won the respect of all. He was a sort of fawn, if we may imagine that the progress of intelligence and civilization for 2,000 years should destroy in that mythical creature something of its old simple spontaneity, and put intellect in its place, while he still retained his close sympathy and association with nature. 69 In the truest meaning of the term, he was a selfish man. That is, as a philosopher, His views of life were centered in self. He believed that self was all that existence held for anyone. Springing out of this selfish philosophy were terrible consequences to others. Outwardly cold in his demeanor, and passing in the estimation of his acquaintances as incapable of emotion, at times there surged through his being tidal waves of passion which swept him off his feet, and when they receded, left on each occasion a fresh victim wrecked and stranded on the beach. I will do him the justice to say that he struggled against these almost periodical tides, struggled as few men ever struggle, but they seemed as resistless as the ocean tides, and at last he came to regard resistance as useless, and saying, "It is fate," yielded himself up to them. When they had passed, humiliated, he would flee from the society of men, and especially from that of women, leading the life of a recluse, no one but himself knowing the thoughts and feelings of his heart. For his victims he felt a sort of tender, romantic pity, nothing more, and as time wore on and took them further and further away from his presence, all the pain of the pity died out, and the remembrance came to be pleasurable. It was impossible that his feelings should reach out so far from self as to enter into their shame, their agony, their remorse, possibly their degradation. He had won himself a name before the world, for he was gifted with a marvelous imagination. Whether in describing scenes, narrating events or depicting passion, he displayed the master hand, and men read and admired, women read and worshipped. The love of such a man was something to be sought, and to be proud of when attained. Therefore unusual temptations beset him, temptations from which he fled in his wiser moments, to which he succumbed in his weaker ones. At last, when he had readied middle life, he met a woman toward whom he was for some reason attracted. She was no longer in the flush of youth, and her beauty had faded. To her innocent woman's nature, totally ignorant of his character, this man's friendship seemed something to be prized. It was the old story of Francesco da Rimini and Paolo. They read together some tale of wild and passionate romance, until at last their lips all trembling kissed. The book and writer both were love's purveyors. In its leaves that day they read no more. And now the scene changed, and I seemed to see the woman's story, and it was this. Marrying early and unfortunately, she had suffered untold agonies in her married life. Though she was a mother, and her maternal instincts had been stirred to their depths, she knew nothing of that conjugal devotion which recognizes maternity as its highest manifestation. Her life had been barren and cold, and when the heel of this man's passion came suddenly upon her, it took her unawares, and with all the innocence of an undeveloped nature she did not at first understand it. When at length its meaning dawned upon her, she realized at the same time that he had become very dear to her, but she did not yield without a struggle. She passed sleepless nights and fasting days. You will say that there ought to have been no doubt, no hesitation in her mind, that the way of right doing was very clear. But you know not, no, no one of you, what your own conduct might be under like circumstances, a like trial. It is possible you might yield without a struggle. As suddenly as he came to her, did her lover desert her? The gust of passion was past, and he had never known the spiritual phase of love. When he came to himself, he felt the old humiliation at his weakness, the old remorse, not for the sin, but that he had not better mastered himself, and penning her a brief note, in which he expressed this humiliation and remorse, and telling her his only safety was in flight, he bade her farewell forever. She was stunned. The blow was so sudden and so severe, it seemed more than she could bear, but when the first poignancy had passed, its effect was to cause her to idolize her lover still more than she had done in the past. He had surely loved her, but had sacrificed that love to his sense of right and duty. Was he not to be revered? 71. And thus she told herself that she ought to feel glad that he had sacrificed her and retrieved his sin. Coming to a consciousness of her great error, and humbled in spirit, she resolved that her whole future life should become an atonement, and thus that became to her a sacrament which was to him a sin. She had wandered unwittingly from the beaten path, and retracing her steps, she went on to the end of her life journey, finding herself, through her very mistake, stronger and wiser, and better prepared to help others. Thus she secretly wore the scarlet letter within her soul, but it became to her, as it was to Hester Prynne, the badge of her higher mission, the reminder of her duty to others, the talisman of spiritual vision, and heaven's peace entered her heart, and wrote itself on her features, so that it was still traced upon her soul after it had quitted the body, as I myself had witnessed. Oh! My dear friends, there are many modern Saint Mary Magdalenes, of whom the world has no knowledge. Now this was my saint, whose very garments I had in my ignorance felt like touching reverently. Where was I? What was I to think? I seemed to be losing all my old bearings. Well, what is your judgment? At last Margaret asked. I know not, I replied. I need your help. Then answer me, was this woman blessed or cursed by this unlawful love? Surely she seemed to be blessed, was my hesitating reply. Were others blessed or cursed because of it through her? Undoubtedly they were blessed, for did I not see the almost innumerable multitude who came to welcome her, and who bore testimony to her good deeds? 72 I draw no conclusions for you, returned Margaret. You must draw them for yourself. But when will mortals realize their own short-sightedness, and learn to suspend their judgment concerning the conduct of others? They cannot look into one another's souls and perceive actuating motives, and in judging superficially they often judge unjustly. They do not realize that sometimes our very sins may become stepping stones to a higher spiritual life, and bring us nearer heaven. But did this woman never learn the real cause of her lover's desertion? No, she has idealized him until this day, and even now she is holding the hope she has cherished for years of meeting and being united with him in this world where it will be no sin. He came to the spirit world years ago. His fierce passions and his mental struggles burnt out his life, and he died prematurely. This woman was his last victim, and he, who never knew what real love is, nor believed in it, but who lived a purely intellectual life, save when scorched by a brief simoon of passion, has found his home in this winter land, where he must remain until the last of his victims has progressed out of the degradation for which he is responsible. See, he shivers. Some of the inhabitants are impervious to cold, but he is not. During all the years since his death he has not been permitted to gain a trace of this woman, and he knows not whether the consequences of his action upon her life have been evil or otherwise. He is dreading the results to himself, for he has not yet learned to think of her, of others, nor has he yet been willing to hasten the day of his deliverance by descending to the darker spheres and helping to lead out those whom his own weaknesses and sins have helped to degrade. But why is it that he himself is not condemned to those darker spheres, like that wretch whom I saw in the valley of the shadow of death? 73 Because there are extenuating circumstances. Because, in fact, he has fought the battle of life against heavy odds, and though he continually failed in many ways, his failures count for him more than many another man's successes, because he struggled more than most. His sentence is to wait loveless and alone until the consequences of his past errors are undone, and he has learned the existence, and come to feel the need of that love which is as far above that passion by which he blasted so many lives, as the higher spheres are above the spheres of darkness and terror, and of oblivion. In brief, he must learn to forget self in the thought of other selves, before he will be free from the fetters of vice which now enchain his soul. But the woman who loves him, who has loved him so faithfully all these years, and who looks forward to meeting with him, will not the disappointment crush her? It might if it came upon her too suddenly. But the knowledge will not come as a disappointment when she is properly prepared to receive it. Their souls are not mates, and she will presently realize that fact, and will be reconciled. In my eagerness to fully master the subject which had been presented to my mind by the experiences just narrated, I talked with others who were endowed with greater wisdom than I, and the following is the substance of what they said to me. In most other matters which concern human welfare, whether political, social or religious, the world has seen many changes. Human thought has been revolutionized many times. Old orders of things have been overturned and annihilated, In spite of the croakings of that large class of conservatives which has existed in all ages, and which always turns its eyes admiringly towards the past, deplores the present, and predicts evil for the future. Chaos has sometimes seemed to result, yet in the end each succeeding condition has shown itself an improvement upon its predecessor. But in the relations of the sexes there has been little inherent change,